Genesis chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring of water on the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going?" She said, "I am fleeing from my mistress Sarai." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen." So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing." For she said, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me." Therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. I wonder if anybody else here has ever felt like a nobody. I wouldn't doubt that somebody here has, maybe all of us at some time. I want to tell you a story about a time when I felt like a total zero. For most of my school years, grade 1 to 12, I lived in very small towns, our family, and went to small schools, small classes. So among other things, that meant that the competition for sports teams was very low. Basically, if you had a pulse, you could play ball. Now my sport was football, maybe because I didn't have a lot of finesse in high school, and it doesn't take a lot of finesse to run into guys and knock them down. But basketball was a different story, and after my first year of high school basketball, Gary Brumbelow and basketball parted company never to meet again. I felt awkward on the court. I felt like I was sticking out like a sore thumb. I didn't know what to do. I was quick to pass the ball, reluctant to shoot. But there was one part of basketball that I understood and I got. I knew my jersey number. I still remember my jersey number. The reason I remember my jersey number is that whenever the coach had a word for me, and it usually wasn't really a word of encouragement, if you get my drift, he never used my name. He couldn't remember my name. He never bothered to learn my name. So he always referred to me by my jersey number. "Hey, 33 this," or "Hey, 33 that." That was who I was to him. I was number 33. Now, I know now, looking back, that he was an even worse coach than I was a player. Because a guy who can't be bothered to learn the names of only probably 10 or 12 guys on the team really probably doesn't qualify to be a coach. But I didn't think through all of that when I was a freshman in high school. All I knew was that my basketball playing was very bad. I was a poor player. And in a world where the sport is everything, and that's how it was in the little school that Valerie and I went to, a player who has no ability is a zero. He's a nobody. And that was me in that time. And being a nobody is no fun. I wonder if you've ever felt like a nobody. I wonder if you've ever felt like you're the one who's excluded from sort of the inner circle, whether that's in school or in your family maybe or other relationships. Maybe you have felt invisible. The one who's left out of the little whispering circle of secrets. Maybe you know what from experience what I'm talking about. And if you do, if you know what it's like to be disregarded, to be disrespected, to feel unimportant, then this chapter, Genesis 16, has something for you today. Because the message of Genesis 16 is that God looks out for the nobody. Really, that to God, nobody is a nobody. That's what we're going to see this morning. But before we jump into the story, let's just kind of get a fix on where we are, because we started this Genesis series months ago, and I don't want us to lose track of where we are. You remember maybe these divisions of Genesis, the two main divisions, primeval history and patriarchal history. Primeval, ancient. Chapters 1 through 11 has the flood, the creation and the flood and the Tower of Babel and all that. Patriarchal, that is of the patriarchs, our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's these five sections in the second category. We are right here in this first section, the account of Terah's line. Terah is the father of Abram. We've been reading about Abram's story. We have a few more chapters of Abram. Today we're going to hear about Abram's firstborn, Ishmael. And then later we'll hear about Isaac, who becomes the father of Jacob and Esau. And if you're familiar with the New Testament, you'll often read Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those are the fathers of the nation of Israel. That's why this is called the patriarchal section, as we see here. And this, you see, all these aren't the same length. This one is just seven verses. This one is like one chapter, and then the rest of them are multiple chapters, so they don't all take the same amount of time. I think after today we may have six more messages in this first section of the account of Terah's line. And if you have any feedback for me about the pace of these messages in Genesis, I would appreciate hearing from you. Now here's a more detailed look at this section here, the account of Terah's line. This computer did this to me before. I don't know why. This is supposed to be indented over, and when it doesn't do that, it really doesn't work. Do you remember we talked about the chiasm? Stay with me here. Chiasm is a Greek word for X, the letter X. Well, this was supposed to go A, B, C, D, E, and then E, F, E, F, and then F, E, B, C, B, A, like this. The structure that the writer uses is actually very intentional, and he's building to a climax in the middle. He starts with the genealogy of Terah, and he ends with the genealogy of Nahor. And then he goes to the promise of a son and the start of Abraham's spiritual odyssey, and the next to the last thing is the birth of a son and the climax of Abraham's spiritual odyssey. So the A's parallel, the B's parallel, the C is Abram lies about Sarah, but God protects her in a foreign palace, and look here, he lies about Sarah again and God protects her in a foreign palace, down here in chapter 20. Lot settles in Sodom in chapter 13, that's the D. Lot flees Sodom and settles in Moab in chapter 19. Abraham intervenes for Sodom and Lot militarily, you might remember that from chapter 14. He intercedes for Sodom and Lot in prayer in chapter 18. And right in the middle is the climax, is where we were last week and we are today, and we will be next time. The covenant with Abraham, Ishmael announced, the covenant with Abraham, Isaac announced. I apologize for the fact that the layout didn't work out. But anyway, that's a more detailed look at this section, the generations of Terah. But today's story has six characters, and here they are: Sarai, Abram, Hagar, the angel
God
and Ishmael. Now, of these characters, four are human and two are divine. Of the humans, two are male and two are female. None of them is innocent, though. Not even Ishmael, who hasn't even been born yet. While he's still in the womb, we read something negative about his character. But each one of these people is of value to God. Each one is important to God. And that's because to God, nobody is a nobody. Everybody has a name to God. You have a name to God. You are of value to Him. But we first read about Sarai here. She's been there all along, as we've been reading mostly about Abram, but of course she's been there all along. What have we been told about Sarai to this point? She's Abram's wife. She's barren. She can't have children. She left Ur with the family and went to Haran, and then left Haran with Abram to go to Canaan. She's beautiful. She is betrayed by Abram and as a result taken into Pharaoh's house. Do you remember that in chapter 12? Because of her, Pharaoh enriches Abram, and because of her, God afflicts Pharaoh with disease. And when he figures out what's going on, and he's actually taken a married woman into his harem, of course he gives her back to Abram, and so she's released after divine intervention. Those are the 10 facts that we've got about Sarai in this story, but one of them overwhelms all of the others. One of them makes really almost everything else insignificant, and that's the first big subject of this story, that's her barrenness. The fact that she can't have children is bigger than everything else. It's what we read at the beginning of this chapter, and it drives everything that happens in the story that I just read. A woman who could not have children in this day, in this part of the world, had a very, very difficult life. She was very vulnerable. Her husband's family could reject her. In fact, her husband could divorce her. She would often be a target of suspicion. She must have been guilty of some kind of indecent behavior. Why else would God close her womb? So the sorrows of a barren woman were many and were very heavy. And the older she got, the more she might panic when she realizes, I'm not going to be able to have children. What can I do? We really probably can't appreciate this fully from the standpoint of our culture these thousands of years later and thousands of miles away from where this happened. But there was one escape route if a woman was wealthy enough to have a servant. She could give her female servant to her husband as a second wife, and the children then would belong to her. And of course, that's just what happens here. Sarai has a female servant, Hagar. Your version might say a maid or a maid servant. Hagar is an Egyptian, maybe acquired from Pharaoh in chapter 12 when he gives Abram all that stuff. A servant has higher status than a slave, but she has to do whatever her mistress tells her, so in effect, really, she is the same thing as a slave. And in this case, she is given to Abram as a wife. She has no say in the matter. Sarai says to Abram, go into Hagar, maybe I will have children through her. So Abram does. Which leads us then to the second big subject of this story, polygamy. Now, we've seen polygamy already in Genesis. I don't know if anyone would remember, but in Genesis chapter 4, we read about Lamech, who had two wives. Technically, it's bigamy, but we're going to lump it all together, bigamy and polygamy. So it's not the first time it's shown up, but this is very different here. This is Abraham, one of the greatest heroes of the Bible, taking a second wife. What is this? What's the deal here? Is God giving his blessing here to polygamy? I mean, almost every American in 2011, not exactly the highest peak of Christian living that you can think about, not to dismiss the Christian heritage and legacy of our country, but almost every American in 2011 would consider this wicked. So how is it that God, it's happening here in the story of Abram, and God seems to be silent about it? What's the deal? Well, it's very important to be clear about this, and the answer has to do with how we read the Bible. What is the Bible doing as it communicates to us about God's authority? And I'm indebted to a British scholar, N.T. Wright, on this next part to understand how the Bible treats the subject of polygamy. First of all, the Bible is not simply a collection of rules and suggestions. It's a story. It's a true story about real people. And like any story, it has good and bad. Sometimes great good, sometimes great wickedness. Only one person in the Bible is perfect. All the rest are a mix of good and bad. And the Bible doesn't gloss over the imperfections of even the great heroes. It's right out there up front with them. It shows us these imperfections. So obviously, one thing that means is not everything in the Bible is given to us as an example, of course. We read about great heroes of the Bible, like Abraham being a polygamist, and we have to ask ourselves, is it giving us an example here of how to live? Now, you've heard me say that God started the creation perfectly, and everything was perfect, but his intentions were messed up at the fall in Genesis chapter 3, when man and woman rebelled against God. And so, as a result of that, God puts into effect a temporary law, the instruction, the law of Moses. And that's where we're going, of course. The book after Genesis is the book of Exodus. We were first introduced to the law of Moses. God puts in place, as a result of the fall, God puts in place the law as a temporary arrangement to guide human behavior. But here's important. He doesn't fix everything by means of this temporary law, because it's only temporary. Something greater is coming. And someone will show up who will say, someone greater than Moses is here. When Jesus shows up, he inaugurates a new beginning, a new inauguration of the kingdom of God. But in the meantime, you have this temporary structure of the law, the instruction of Moses. It doesn't fix everything that's broken. And one of the things that it doesn't fix is polygamy. So we have great heroes of the Bible like Abraham and David taking two or more wives. Does that mean that's okay with God? I mean, we have Mormon groups today who still practice polygamy. Do they have biblical support for this? Well, we can be unequivocal in our response to that. No. Not unless we cut the New Testament out of our Bibles. Because Jesus is very clear about God's view of marriage. So, for example, on a different but related subject, he says that divorce, he says to the Pharisees, God permitted divorce because of the hardness of your hearts, but that God's view of marriage was always one man, one woman for life. Paul restates this in his letter to the Ephesian church. That's God's view of marriage, and he expects us to obey it. And further than that, he's going somewhere with history. He's building his kingdom even now. And as you've heard me say, the entire Bible after Genesis 4 is the story of God restoring his original design, and we are to get in line with his original intent and purposes. It's not okay for us to just live however we want to. We live under the authority of King Jesus, and he has something to say about this. Our lives are to line up with God's original purposes as he originally designed. So what God first said to Adam and Eve in the garden, what Jesus repeated to the Pharisees, and what Paul wrote to the church still defines God's view and picture of marriage today. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And by the way, when we follow God's laws, things just go a lot better. That's amazing how that works. When you follow the laws of the one who made you, life just works so much better. Read the stories of polygamy in the Bible, and you'll read of tension, of conflict, of heartache, of sorrow. That's because that was never God's intention. Things work so much better when we obey God. So yes, polygamy is in the story, but that doesn't make it acceptable. Now, Abram is another character in this story today, but we've been hearing lots about him, so let's move on to Hagar. What do we know about Hagar? She's a woman. She's an Egyptian. She is Sarai's servant. She lives at the bidding of her mistress. A servant is one level of status above a slave, but at any time Sarai is displeased with her, she can brand her as a slave. So she's a female servant, separated from her homeland and her family and her people. She has no freedom, no choices, no prospects, no status. Hagar is truly a nobody, but not to God. So, in the story we read, Abram goes into Hagar and she conceives. And when she realizes that she's pregnant, now we see the ugly side of Hagar, which exposes the ugly side of Sarai as well. Look in verse 4. He went into Hagar and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. Hagar despises her mistress now that she, Hagar, has managed to conceive. And years, generations later, Solomon will write something in the Proverbs that's the perfect illustration of this. Maybe he had the story in mind when he wrote these words. Under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up. A servant who becomes king, a fool who is full of food, an unloved woman who is married, and a maid servant who displaces her mistress. That's exactly what happens here. And as I said a minute ago, polygamy inevitably brings problems. And that's, of course, what happens here. Sarai completely reverses her attitude. She had wanted Hagar to conceive so that Hagar's children could be counted as her own and she could escape the shame of her childlessness. But Hagar's contempt, now that she's pregnant, becomes unbearable for Sarai. And we can maybe imagine how this might have played out. Oh, mistress, I'll fetch water for you in just a moment, but this morning sickness has just wiped me out. You have no idea. Or maybe, you know, I just need to lie down for a little while. We wouldn't want anything to happen to Abram's baby. Who knows? Who knows what it might have looked like, but there was definitely a new level of tension in the home, if that's the fair word. And now for Sarai, life with Hagar has become unbearable. So she unloads on Abram, as we read. This is your fault. She loses any sense, really, I would say, of good judgment about what happened here. And we have Abram's only words recorded in the story in verse 6. Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please. Kind of wimped out there, I would say. Whatever you want to do, honey. So now Sarai turns and all of her frustrations, she vents all of her jealousy and all of her fears and who knows what emotions on this girl. So now that Hagar finds life unbearable and it gets so bad that she decides to take drastic action. Alone and pregnant, she takes off into the wilderness on foot. She travels for maybe a week, goes perhaps 70 miles through inhospitable territory, and we find her next, it says, by the spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur. Now, when you look at a map, you can see where she's going. She's been over here, and God meets her here. Where is she headed? She's going home. She's going to Egypt. Where else would she go? Has she thought about this? Has she thought this through? Has she considered the risk? We really don't know. But her desperation is clear enough. She has to leave. She has to get out of there. Whether she would ever have reached Egypt, we don't know. Because before she gets really that far, she has a divine interruption. She meets someone she never could have expected. And here's something she could never have anticipated. Hagar the Egyptian, Hagar the maidservant, Hagar the proud mother-to-be of Abram's son, Hagar the nobody, is about to meet the ultimate somebody, and things will never be the same for her. You know, there are so many lessons for us in this story. Here's one. Do you ever feel that God has forgotten about you? Do you ever feel that He's not listening to you? Have you ever prayed for Him to do something, to maybe intervene in a relationship or help you with a problem, and it seems like nothing happens and you think, well, what's the deal, God? Aren't you listening to me? Don't you know that I'm hurting here? You know, that's really where Abram was in chapter 15. Do you remember at the beginning of the chapter, God said something to him, your reward is going to be very great. And he says, God, how can you talk to me about a reward? I don't even have a son. A reward makes no sense to me in my situation. And that's much like Hagar's story here. See, God had not intervened when there was conflict between Sarai and Hagar. He looked on while all that was happening. He continued to look on while Hagar packs and while she sets out on this dangerous journey. I really don't think Hagar knows God yet at this point, but if she had, she might have concluded that He had abandoned her, but that would be the wrong conclusion. Just as it would be wrong for you to think that God has abandoned you. Because the fact of the matter is that God is just about to show up and explode her reality. But first we need to meet another character, one who will show up again in the Bible later on, the angel of the Lord. Look at verse 7. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. Now, we know about angels. Angels are holy spirit beings who do God's work, who serve God, vast in number, and they serve God. One of the ways they serve God are to take His messages to humans, just as is happening here. But notice this exact phrase, the angel of the Lord. Sometimes when we read about angels in the Bible, it just says, an angel came. Or sometimes it will say the angel's name, the angel Gabriel. But this term, the angel of the Lord, is a little bit different. And there are scholars who believe that this phrase is used to designate someone who is more than just an angel. Because one of the reasons they say that is that although the angel of the Lord is clearly distinguished from God, also it seems like the angel of the Lord is sometimes equated with God. Sometimes when we hear the angel of the Lord, we are hearing the words of God as we read. And in fact, in verse 13, look what verse 13 says. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you are a God of seeing. Hagar was convinced that God came and met with her. So many scholars, not all, believe that this person is actually this the angel of the Lord. When you see that in the Old Testament, this is the second person of the Trinity. This is God the Son, who will become incarnate, who will be born as a man in the village of Bethlehem after these things. So there's some reason to believe, because, and again, the idea is that the angel of the Lord is sometimes equal with God, sometimes distinct from God. And there's a sense in which maybe this is another person of the Trinity who is one with God, and yet as Jesus walked on the earth, He was also the Son of God. And I don't have time to get into, even if I could explain the Trinity, I just want you to see that there are some who believe that the person who met with Hagar today in the story is the Son of God. And that's quite enough to think about. We could park and think about that for a while, but we must move on, so let's just kind of keep that in our hearts as we move on and see what is it that transpires between the angel and Hagar. And I'm going to just use the term God for shorthand rather than the angel of the Lord every time. What happens first? First, God finds her. You see that? In verse 7, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water. Now, that doesn't mean that God had to look for her because he couldn't figure out where she was. It means that he took the initiative to come to her. He knew exactly where she was, of course. But he comes to her. He's just been waiting for the right moment to show up in her life. And now, when she least expected it, God shows up. So what does God do next? Well, it's easy to miss, but it's huge, especially to her. What is it in verse 8? He says, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? He uses her name. Did you see that? He calls Hagar by her name. Have you ever noticed that when you're in a conversation, when you're in a conversation with someone and they use your name, or when you're introduced to someone, whose name do you listen for? Well, we should listen to for the other person's name so we can remember it. But if you're like me, I always catch my name. Why is that? Well, our name is important to us. It captures who we are. And when someone of higher sort of status than us uses our name, we're honored by that. We're valued by that. God calls Hagar by her name. We sang, "He knows my name." And this had to blow her away to think about that the God of the universe is calling her by name. He looks for her and finds her. He calls her by name. And then he has a conversation with her. Verse 8, he says, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? Or where are you going? Now you think, you mean God didn't know where she had come from and where she was going? Yes, God knows everything. The Bible is very clear about that. He didn't ask her because he didn't know. He asked her because he wanted to engage her in conversation. He knows all about her, but he wants to call her out, to draw her out into this conversation. It's like when he showed up in the garden after the fruit in chapter 3. Do you remember what he asks Adam? Where are you, Adam? It's like that. It's God calling someone out, drawing her into the conversation. And note that the angel directs her in verse 9, go back to your mistress Sarai and submit to her. Now that's interesting, but think about this for a minute. God knows exactly what your circumstances are. He says, Hagar, servant of Sarai. He knows who she is. He knows what her circumstances are. And he sends her back into those circumstances just as he often does you, because he knows that difficult circumstances, he's using them for some purpose that you can't see. We can't see God. We can't see the purposes of God. Is it because God is too invisible for us to see? No, it's because he's too big for us to see. We're like the little bug walking across a man's hand on the little ant walking across a man's hand. He can't see the man. Is it because the man is too invisible or small? No. It's because the man is too real. The bug can't see the man. We can't see God. We can't see his purposes because they're so vast and so big. What does he ask us to do? Trust. And obey. He sends Hagar back into those difficult circumstances just as he does you. It's not that he doesn't hear your prayers, and it's not that if your circumstances don't change, he's ignoring you. He has something in mind. He's doing something that you can see. He calls us to trust him and obey him. Will you do that? Do you know that's the secret to joy and peace? And to fail to trust him and to fail to obey him is the road to despair. But he isn't finished, not even close. Look at verse 10. The angel of the Lord says, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Whoa! He must have her attention now, although I'm not sure she was even able to process what he's saying because how she responds later. She's going to become the mother of a multitude. That sounds familiar. Somebody else has heard that promise. Oh, it's the father of this baby that she's carrying. This is what God has promised Abram. I can't take the time, but if you want to jot it down, chapter 12, verse 2, chapter 13, verse 16, and chapter 15, verse 5, God has already said to Abram three times, you're going to be the father of a multitude. Now Hagar, pregnant with his child, gets the same promise, you're going to be the mother of a multitude. And then he goes on to elaborate, behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. She knew she was pregnant, but now she finds out the sex of this baby and something about the character of this child. And I'm told, a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, is not a bad description of the Arab peoples. And I just said something I need to back up. Ishmael will become the father of the Arab peoples. All of the Arabs are sons of Ishmael. And there's some intrigue in that too. We'll touch on that in just a second. But this description of the Arab peoples, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against them, I'm told the Arabs have a proverb, myself against my brother, my brother and I against my cousin and I against the stranger. Lots of conflict there. And that's what God describes here. The Arabs are not famous for being a gentle, subdued people. And that fiery spirit begins right here in the womb of Hagar. And God says this is what it's going to look like as he speaks to Hagar, the mother of the Arab peoples. They will become enemies of the Jews, of course, who are the children of Abram's other son, Isaac. And of course, one Arab in particular, one of the Arabs whose name is Mohammed, will start a religion that will become the world's second largest religion, the religion of Islam, one that is the religion of about 95% of the Arab people today. And one that few Americans knew much about before September 11, 2001. And most probably still don't know that Muslims, many Muslims, the Arab Muslims, consider Abraham their father, just as Jews and Christians do also, because the Arabs are the sons of Ishmael. And all of that history of the Arab peoples begins right here in Genesis 16. And you know what? We haven't heard the end of their story. I'm struck with something like wonder to think that we have here the Lord, the angel of the Lord, maybe the pre-incarnate Christ in conversation with the mother of the Arabs. Who knows what God may have in mind? The writer wants to be very clear, and the way he closes this chapter, that Abraham is the father of the Ishmaelites, and so he spells all that out in verse 15. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael, so that the Jews would know the Arabs are your cousins. They're your kinfolk. And it's clear that the promise that God gave Abram of many descendants applies also to Ishmael as well as to Isaac. Bruce Waltke says, Abraham will father many descendants, both elect and non-elect. The non-elect will also be protected by God and made into a great nation. So in fact, not only do we have perhaps the pre-incarnate Christ speaking to the mother of the Arabs, but we have her testimony about it, and this is what brings this to a close. Look at verse 13. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you are a God of seeing. For she said, truly here I have seen him who looks after me. Therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. She hears all of this, And this is what I was saying earlier. She doesn't say anything about the multitudes. She doesn't say anything about the character of the Son. She is still stunned by what has happened here. You see me. God, you see me. I'm not invisible to you. You used my name. And she is completely blown away by this personal encounter with God. She was a nobody, but God knew her. Look at this. Sarai had driven her away. Whoops. Let's see here. I think I need your help back there. Oh, that was the last one. I'm sorry, my bad. On your handout, there's a table there on your handout at the bottom. Sarai had driven Hagar away. There's columns down there. But God sought her out. Sarai called her my servant, but God called her Hagar. Sarai talked about her, but God speaks with her. Sarai regarded her a threat, but God regards her as a gift. And I ask you, what kind of God is this? Because you see, it's not about Hagar. It's not that Hagar had some special quality that God would seek her out. It's about the God who sought her out. What kind of God is this? Who stoops to have a conversation with a foreign slave woman in rebellion against him, contemptuous of her mistress, truly a nobody. That's the God that we worship. That's the God who will show up in the flesh and whose love and compassion will be extended to everyone that he meets, who feeds the hungry and heals the broken, and who gives his life in exchange for your life, who becomes a nobody really, who is forsaken by his own Father, who hangs on the cross and says, my God, why have you forsaken me? In the hour, in the moment where God the Father says, for your sake, where he says to his own Son, I don't know you, the sins of the world are on his shoulders, in that moment he is forsaken and he becomes a nobody so that you can know the favor of God. That's the kind of God he is. That's the kind of God we worship today. Our praise and worship truly belong to him. Father, we bow with, what can we say? Grateful hearts, certainly, for these truths. Grant, Lord, from your Spirit's work that the impact of this would lie on our hearts at a new level and would change us to be more like what you want. Lord, there's somebody here who is still outside your family who's never responded to your gracious summons. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Lord, who has never come to you for their forgiveness, has never turned around and repented of their life. Lord, show them the wonder and the joy of all that you have for them. Show them even in this moment as we sing. In Jesus' precious name, amen.